going to start with Professor Judith Resnick from Yale, who's going to give us some background to understand what are the courts today and what are the roots of the issue that we're here to discuss. Some of it is rather counterintuitive, and I think you'll find it both enlightening and even somewhat entertaining.
Hello, I'm actually aspiring to show pictures. So the question one is there anything on the screen? Because I can't see it from here. Yeah. The second is, can any of you see it? Yes, there is functioning. And the remote control, my colleague on the panel is the remote control. So he and I will coordinate. It's very sweet for me to be here. I'm honored to join Justice O'Connor, who has been a leader on this issue, and it's very nice to have the occasion to say thank you in public for all of her work on this issue, as well as to our conveners, Leslie, and to Linda, who have regularly brought together many groups to address the question of the role of courts. It's kind of a sleeper issue in some ways, and your commitment to its public dissemination is great. And then to Ricky Revez and John Sexton, it's very nice to be home because I'm a graduate of the NYU Law School and feel very pleased to be back. Marty Lipton taught me securities regulation as a law student here. So it seemed to me, as Justice O'Connor was also talking about, to the degree to which we take for granted the concept of judicial independence, that it'd be worth looking a little bit at the history of the story of judges going back hundreds of years, because adjudication predates democratic practices. And so I wanted to invite you back to 1498 in Bruges, the first pictures on the screen. And there's a large painting. I'm going to show you a few paintings from town halls, which were the first courts in civic centers around Europe. And this first image hung in the town hall of Bruges, and it is a diptych. Its first piece is called the Judgment of Cambyses. And if you can see in the far back, I can't see the screen, but there's a tiny little back image where there's a guy in a red robe who's a judge, and he's taking a bribe. It's a bag of money. And then in the front, what you're seeing is that judge taken from the seat of judgment and being arrested. And if you go to the next image, you're seeing that he's flayed alive. And this doesn't do a moment's worth of justice, if I borrow that word, to the actual paintings, which are gruesome in detail and are very big and hung in the town hall. And then in the very back of that screen, there's a little back image. That's the son of the corrupt judge. He's the new judge, and he's forced to sit on the skin that was his father's. This image isn't unique to Bruges. It hung all over town halls in Europe. Move forward 100 years or so to 1604 Geneva, the next. It's called Les Jugements Coupés. It's a huge mural, and if you take the next little excerpt, you'll see more clearly that it's judges with their hands cut off. And it says, with a text from Exodus, the text says, "Thou shalt not accept gifts, for a gift, for a present blinds the prudent and distorts the words of the just." I take it that would be helpful for West Virginia as well. About 50 years later, moving forward now to Amsterdam, we see the magnificent opening of this large 1660s building. And if you go to the next image, you walk inside a room called the Tribunal where death sentences were pronounced. And then if you go to the next image, you're going to look at what the public watching from the streets and what the defendant saw. These are carvings. The first one's called the Judgment of Brutus. Brutus was the Roman envoy. His sons were treacherous, and so he ordered his own sons to their death for their treason. The next picture, the Judgment of Zaleucus. He was a judge. His son violated the laws of the state. The punishment was gouge out your eyes. Instead of taking out both of his son's eyes, he took out one of his as well. Now, these paintings were all over the European countryside, and they helped me make a first point. The judicial role was then conceived to be dependent, not independent. These exemplary stories provided instruction to judges to serve as loyal servants of the state, and if you misbehaved, you'd be flayed alive or lose your limbs. Enforcing the state's law, furthermore, came at personal pain. Be loyal to the state, even if it means sending your own children to death or to dismemberment. Why were these images around Europe? That answer gives me a second point, which is they were normative instructions, rituals, and spectacles of power aiming to provide instruction to the public, watching from the streets or inside these buildings. But as Michel Foucault famously reports, those who produce rituals and spectacles can't control all. They don't have totalizing power. And so people watching move from being passive spectators to becoming more active, more watchful, to understanding themselves as having some power to sit in judgment as they watch the procedures, and as with the growth of Republican and Democratic precepts to make claims on the state. And so then on to a third point, that during the 17th, 18th, and 19th century, we watched two parallel and related developments, the growth of ideas of judges as independent, interacting with an obligation to do judgment in public and open court proceedings. We watched rights, R-I-T-E-S, become rights, R-I-G-H-T, of public access as judges move from servants to independent actors. And so to show you some of this, I need to switch from paintings to text and cross the Atlantic to the United States. The next figure is a little bit of text from the laws of West New Jersey from the 1670s. And here it says, all courts have to be public. People have to be able to come freely. Justice may not be done in any covert way, in any manner or the like. Move to the next image. This is the icon of the federal system. This is Article 3 of the United States Constitution, already introduced to you by Justice O'Connor, a new conception of judges protected from being fired, life, tenure, and their salaries not to be diminished. Not raised enough, but not to be diminished. The next, Justice O'Connor's introduced you to the Massachusetts Constitution. Let me take you to Vermont. Here's the commitment in 1777. Courts are open, justice shall be impartial. Now let's move to the 20th century and globalize. This is the Global Law School, after all. And here we are in the European Convention of Human Rights in the 1950s and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights in 1966. What are they all saying? Independent judges, open courts, global democratic precepts around the world. And now move to one more text, South Africa, 1996. Its constitution, a new national constitution with the same commitments. So pause for a fast summary of 500 years. Proposition 1, the role of the judge was once to be subservient, and Proposition 2, public rituals taught, instilled this idea in both judges and the public as spectators. Proposition 3, over time, public practices became a springboard for rights, R-I-G-H-T, as participants laid claim to procedural fairness, to democratic precepts, as persons employed by the state came to be independent of it, and constitutional texts around the world, 300 years of it, time and again, link open courts and independent judging. Jeremy Bentham in the 1800s said, when a judge presides at trial, that judge is themselves on trial, for they can be watched, they can be assessed by their audience. And from the baseline of Renaissance Europe, that's a pretty radical endowment of authority in we the people. So now let's talk about the 20th century for just a couple minutes and on to a fourth point, which is with democracy, demands for adjudication have just soared. All of us in this room 150 years ago, even 100 years, we weren't all juridical persons. We weren't rights holders. We couldn't bring all sorts of different kinds of claims. But democracy has endowed us all with rights, and so now we're looking at the demand side growing. So the next graph shows you just a little bit. I'm just showing you life tenure judges in the federal system in 1900, roughly. We're looking at a fewer than 100 around the entire United States. By the end of the 20th century, we're looking at more than 800 or so. These are the life tenured Article III constitutional judges. But they aren't for a second sufficient to the amount of rights that we all are demanding be adjudicated. And so judges, lawyers, Congress, and the courts, working cooperatively, not adversarially, basically invented new kinds of judges for the federal system. They're called magistrate and bankruptcy judges. They're creatures of the 1970s and 1980s. And their figures grow so that the next image, I think, shows you some glimpse of the numbers of them. And they work, if we go to the next image, in the St. Louis, Missouri courthouse. This is the largest federal courthouse in the United States. It's 29 stories tall, probably more square footage than the Amsterdam Town Hall. This imposing building is but a tip of the iceberg of the adjudicatory work in the United States. counting every activity in every federal courthouse around the United States in which witnesses testify in a year, our best guess is we're looking at about 100,000 proceedings. But lots of you might be immigrants, in which case you're interested in the Immigration Service, or you might be veterans, in which case you'd be at the Veterans Service, or you might have Social Security claims in the Social Security Administration, or be employees. And in 1 year, those four federal agencies alone do more than 700,000 proceedings a year. So if you look at the next image, where am I on the screen here? I'm looking at, what number am I at? At 17, so I'm looking at how those non-life tenured statutory judges tower over all the judges in the Article III courthouses. And if I do the last slide then, I'm looking at how their business towers over that of the courthouses that you see. So now, here we are at the end of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st. And what do we make of our claims? We have enormous textual commitments to independent and impartial judging and open and public courts. But I've just shown you hundreds of thousands of proceedings that occur not in large public buildings, but in office buildings, not open to street traffic, not visible at all. Moreover, those judges work not with life tenure and protected salaries. Some of them are actually line employees. We know recently that so-called judges in the immigration court were reassigned when their bosses, the Department of Justice, didn't like some of the decisions that they were making. Hence, a fifth point, that when devolving business from life tenure judges to administrative judges, Congress did not provide and the Supreme Court did not insist that the rights we associate with judges, open trials, public access, robust independence, go all the way down the judicial food chain to lower echelon judges working in these lower echelon administrative courts. And of course, we can see that it matters as judges are, if not flayed alive, reassigned or fired. So now on to a sixth point, which is to focus only on the risk of judges coming from the executive or congressional branches is to miss a part of the 20th century. The 20th century is the world of the repeat player litigant. The people who are in court over time and say, gee, wouldn't it be nice if I could have judges I like? So some of them contribute to campaigns when there's judicial election. And if it's judicial appointments, some of them try very hard to influence the selection. So we can talk about the National Council of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, the American Trial Lawyers, varieties of different associations, NGOs, and the like, all of whom are trying to be either, who could be either friends or foes of judicial independence. And here I am sharing a panel with one of the great journalists of the judiciaries. And so, of course, the point is the other 20th century invention and exploration of and source of our knowledge about courts is, of course, the media, as I see other members here in the audience as well. And therefore, either we're dependent on the media, and judges are dependent on the media, both for either paying no attention or for paying too much attention, for singling out and for educating us. And so hence, to a conclusion, and my final point, texts, and here I will echo what Justice O'Connor said, texts like Article III or the South African Constitution or the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights are terrific, but are not sufficient for a moment to create judicial independence. The challenge is how to build a culture of commitment to independent judges and then how to spread it from our most visible federal and state judges to those other judges working in very low visibility but incredibly important settings for the lives of the people whose decisions affect them so much. These are the bulk of the adjudicatory procedures in the United States. And one answer to that is to insist on public processes, to insist on structural protections, to say that judges can't be reassigned or fired, and not to let them work behind closed doors in outsourced, devolved, or secretive proceedings, but rather to insist that the public play a role. We have to work up and down the range of the judiciary, and actually, as I argued in the Daedalus, we actually have many judiciaries. We need to pluralize the concept, and we need those judges to be independent, because we're actually very dependent upon them. Thank you.